Blog Talk Radio.
From the hidden valleys of Tibet and the stunning pyramids of Mexico, to the icy wastes of the Antarctic and the deepest ocean trenches, our search for Atlantis will take us all across the world to seek out ancient clues of a civilization that perished before history had even begun. An object of endless fascination and relentless obsession. It is a quest through time and space to pivotal moments in human history, as well as the dark side of man's longing for perfection. The myth of Atlantis has cast its spell over generations, each trying to find its own unique vision of this lost, idyllic paradise. Our journey will take us across oceans and continents and span 10,000 years of human history. A journey to find a magical lost world. The search for Atlantis has captivated some of the most restless minds and original thinkers of every generation. It is a search that begins here, in the most glorious city of ancient Greece, Athens. In the 4th century BC, Athens was a city preeminent in all the world, the very epicenter of classical civilization and a beacon of cultural and artistic excellence that has shone through the ages right down to the present day. And it was here, in the world's first democracy, that philosopher Plato wrote a story, 3.5 centuries before the time of Christ, that is the first account of Atlantis in all literature.
The fact that Plato originated the story of Atlantis gave it a great amount of weight. Plato was essentially the father of Western philosophy, and because what he had to say was so important and has remained important, it became much more acceptable, much more respectable, if you will, than if someone else had written it.
Plato wrote his account of Atlantis towards the end of his life, but it was first told at a dinner party that took place when he was only a young boy. An account that, somehow, he must have overheard. The gathering, hosted by Plato's uncle, was traditional to the day, where wealthy and learned Greek men would eat, drink, tell stories, and exchange ideas. Among the guests was Plato's teacher, the great philosopher Socrates, and perhaps it was to be near his brilliant mentor that the young Plato sneaked in to listen to all that the men had to say. The legend of Atlantis, he learned, was already generations old, handed down by a famous Greek sage and lawgiver called Solon, who learned the tale in Egypt.
Solon was one of the seven sages of ancient Greece. He was a very, very important personality historically because he was a lawgiver and he established the basis from which Athenian democracy eventually developed. He was a poet and a scientist and a statesman, and one of the things that he did is to have visited Egypt. It's almost like a pilgrimage that all the ancient Greek sages made, and in Egypt he first supposedly heard the story of Atlantis.
In the holiest shrine of the ancient Egyptian capital, Solon was shown records of unsurpassed antiquity. The secrets of a long-lost age when a civilization of incomparable power and prestige had dominated the world 9,000 years before. The Empire of Atlantis. The description the Egyptian priest gave to Solon of this mighty, vanished civilization is the starting point for every search ever undertaken to find Atlantis. A description which Plato says
has the great advantage of being a fact and not a fiction.
Atlantis was said to lie beyond the Pillars of Hercules, outside the Mediterranean Sea, in an ocean we now call the Atlantic.
Plato was very, very specific about where Atlantis was and what size it was, and he described it as being larger than the continents of Africa and Asia put together, and he located it very carefully outside the Pillars of Hercules. The Pillars of Hercules are what we know now as the Straits of Gibraltar. And when you locate something outside the Pillars of Hercules, you are locating it in the Atlantic Ocean, just to the west of Spain and North Africa.
Atlantis was dominated by a vast, almost perfectly rectangular plain, surrounded on three sides by high, very beautiful mountains. Possessed of abundant natural resources, rare plants and precious flowers of every description, even elephants and other exotic animals, Atlantis was a land like no other, where the people wanted for nothing.
That sacred island, which then beheld the light of the sun, brought forth infinite abundance and the blessing.
He tells us about the flowers, the plants, the kind of metals the people use, the kind of the way that each canal and each channel is built. He puts in elephants. In fact, it's only the second time that they're mentioned in Greek literature when Plato describes Atlantis. What does all that piling up of detail and very strange detail do? Well, it does two things. First, it makes it very exotic and something very strange. But because there's so much of it, it also makes it seem real.
On the edge of this plain, facing the open sea, was the spectacular capital city of Atlantis. Laid out in a series of concentric circles of land and water.
The circle for the Greeks, for Plato in particular, but for the Greeks in general, the circle is a perfect geometrical shape. Circular motion is a perfect kind of motion. By building it in circles, he allows it to manifest the geometrical perfection that he finds the world really exhibits, even if we don't see it every day.
Each ring of land was home to new wonders and marvels.
There were docks for huge numbers of ships and a causeway over which they could offload the riches that were coming into Atlantis. In other words, everything that human beings could need was available in Atlantis itself.
Connected to the ocean by an immense canal 100 feet deep and several miles long, at the very center of the city was the dazzling citadel of Atlantis, which housed the most spectacular treasures that ever graced the earth.
They had such an amount of wealth as was never before possessed by kings and is not likely ever to be again.
Plato tells us that for long ages the Atlanteans lived at peace with the rest of the world on their beautiful island paradise. Unspoiled by their material possessions and great wealth, they were concerned only with learning, cultivating virtue, and living in harmony with nature. Yet finally this golden age passed and the Atlanteans became like other mortals.
Human nature got the upper hand. They became tainted with unrighteous ambition and power.
Insatiable for wealth and glory, the Atlanteans pushed forward the bounds of their empire, enslaving all before them. Finally, only one city stood between Atlantis and world domination. But here at the hands of the Athenians, the armies of Atlantis suffered a crushing defeat for the first time. A defeat that was swiftly followed by a natural disaster that laid waste to most of the world, completely destroying the islands of Atlantis.
Violent earthquakes and floods, a And in a single day and night of misfortune, the island of Atlantis disappeared in the depths of the sea.
And within day and night, both Atlantis and the Athenians who fought the Atlanteans disappear from the face of the earth. The only ones who are left are a few uncultured, as the Egyptians tell Solon, Athenians who no longer remember the story of their triumph against the foreign invaders. And that's why they have to learn it again from the Egyptians when Solon visits them.
It was this tragic tale first relayed to Solon in Egypt, which many years later was told at an Athenian dinner party. A story that might have been entirely lost were it not for the uninvited young guest who, it seems, remembered every word. All of the other guests scoffed at this incredible story of a lost paradise, all save Plato's teacher, Socrates. In order to convince the others of the story's truth, Plato's uncle agreed to explain more. Zeus, he said, had convened a council of the gods and spoken to them thus. But at this point, Plato's account abruptly stops. It is almost as if something or someone prevented him from writing more. Why did he never finish the story?
We don't know why he never finished the story. He stopped it in mid-sentence, actually, and we can assume that he intended to finish it. He didn't die at that moment, and in fact there are works of Plato's that can be dated after the completion of Timaeus and Critias, the dialogues in which Atlantis is discussed.
Nevertheless, Plato's short account of an after-dinner conversation was the beginning of a myth that continues to inspire and provoke 24 centuries later. Strangely, though, despite Plato setting up the world's first university, called the Academy, the subject of Atlantis seems to have been largely neglected by his pupils.
The myth of Atlantis, the story of Atlantis, is one that people seem to have been disputing about from the very beginning, whether it was true or not true. And we have one of his successors who actually believed it was a true story, which suggests that there are others who didn't believe it was a true story. However, what is interesting about the story of Atlantis is that unlike many other stories that people knew not to be true, this inveterate race of storytellers never picks up to make anything of. We don't have versions of Atlantis the same way that we have versions of the Trojan War or of Jason's expedition to get the Golden Fleece or all the other great stories of Greek mythology. Nobody picks up that story to make something of it. It sort of sinks very much in the way that Atlantis itself sank in the depths of the ocean for a very long time.
The myth of Atlantis would be lost, disappearing into the shadows of the Dark Ages. It wouldn't be until European explorers inaugurated an age of discovery that the search for a lost island paradise began with fervor. A search that would begin with the dogged pursuit of a mythical isle by history's most famous explorer, Christopher Columbus. Holy Inquisition of Spain. Men of God scour the land, searching for any sign of deviation from the one true faith. In less than a decade, thousands have already perished. Jews and Moors, lapsed Christians and social outcasts, all consumed by the cleansing fire of religious zeal. In such an atmosphere of terror, Spain would seem an unlikely starting point for Christopher Columbus's unprecedented voyage of discovery. Yet it was to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, the very people who had set the Inquisition in motion, that Columbus would have to appeal to finance his bold plan to cross the ocean. Long neglected by the history books, the great navigator had a secret reason to undertake such a perilous voyage. Columbus had heard of a lost island paradise of untold riches and wealth, a mythical land called Antillia, a land that had replaced Atlantis in the medieval imagination. Since the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 6th century, much of the learning of antiquity had been forgotten. Suspicious of pagan wisdom, Christianity had evolved a very different vision of the world, one defined by the battle between good and evil. At the center of this world was Jerusalem, surrounded by the three known continents: Europe, Asia, and Africa. Beyond this was a netherworld, populated by people who were not descended from Adam and Eve, making them, in the minds of many, children of the devil. But some, like Columbus, had radical ideas about the real geography of the world, ideas that had made him an obvious figure of suspicion. Columbus had a great ally, knowledge. Knowledge gained from travel stories and maps of dubious origin. Knowledge that might threaten his very life.
It took Columbus a very long time to convince Isabella and Ferdinand that he ought to be able to find something, because for the most part his ideas were ridiculed, and this was of course during the Inquisition, so that people who had strange or antithetical ideas were not only ridiculed, they were sometimes burned at the stake.
Mocked and abused even by children, it had taken Columbus 8 long years to persuade Ferdinand and Isabella to finance his voyage. They did so for trade. Muslim conquest of the Holy Lands had reduced their valuable commerce with the Far East to a trickle. A new route to the riches of the Indies had to be found.
Up until the mid-15th century, all of these precious goods got to Europe by way of overland caravans. But in 1453, when the Turks invaded, they cut off these trade routes. So if the nations of Europe wanted to get these goods, they had to find an alternate way, and that would have to be a sea route.
Above all, maps were the key.
To a European king, a map was treasure beyond anything else in the world, because it gave him access to the new world, to treasure, to the future. And everybody kept their maps under lock and key, and to steal a map from another country was a great coup.
Armed with the most recent maps of Europe's best cartographers, Columbus had a better picture of the world than most of his contemporaries. His maps were much like our own, save for one all-important exception. The undiscovered continent of America was entirely absent. These maps also suffered from another dangerous defect. No one knew what lay in the Atlantic itself. The ocean was a mystery.
It was a fearful undertaking. It was one that would not be taken lightly. And there was still the existence of legends of sea monsters that would grapple with their ship and pull them down. And there is always the problem of the potential of making it there, but can we make it back?
Christian folklore suggested an ocean teeming with islands, but how many of them really existed? There was one mythical island whose existence the great navigator considered absolutely certain. Antillia.
I don't think it was doubted that Antillia existed, and it was constantly shown on maps. No one ever doubted it. Its position was always in the middle of the Atlantic, and it would have been what they call the stepping stone route, that Columbus saw this as a good stepping stone on the way to the Far East.
According to the writing of his son Ferdinand, Columbus's fascination with Antillia began when he met a one-eyed sailor in the Azores.
It was while sailing in the Azores that my father, the admiral, met a one-eyed sailor to seek the story of Antigua.
The sailor claimed to be a survivor of an expedition that had glimpsed this legendary realm and told him of a land of seven cities founded by seven bishops in the distant past. Home to wonders and marvels beyond the imagination, Antillia was said to be a land of limitless wealth. Even its beaches were sprinkled with gold.
The final motive my father, the Admiral, undertook was the hope of finding, before he arrived in the Indies, some island and land of great utility.
An island of great utility that was almost certainly Antillia.
We only have Columbus's journal. We know that he thought he was looking for the Indies, but we know also that he was looking for gold and spices and riches, and certainly at least part of what he was doing was looking for Antillia or Atlantis.
On August 2nd, 1492, as Columbus finally set off on his epic voyage to cross the Atlantic Ocean, he had not one, but two goals in mind: crossing the endless expanse of an uncharted sea and discovering the mysteries of an island called Antillia. History has recorded only scant evidence of the events of Columbus's momentous journey. We do know that when his expedition was 12 days out from the Canary Islands and 2,000 miles from Spain, he ordered his tiny three-ship fleet to set a northwesterly course in precisely the direction that Antillia was thought to be. 2 days later, he ordered the ships to turn west again, and 2 days after that, they set a course southwest. After 6 days of searching, Columbus abandoned what appears to have been a frantic search for Antillia. The decision probably saved the expedition. Columbus had made a potentially fatal error. In common with the mapmakers, he had estimated the size of the world based on calculations of Arabic scholars.
The problem is that that measurement was made in Arabic miles, which are much longer than Italian miles, with the result that all the geographical thinkers take the Earth to be much, much smaller than it really was.
On the 12th of October, after nearly 3 months at sea, Columbus and his men finally made landfall. They had crossed the vast ocean and reached the Americas. Returning to Spain a hero, Columbus managed to persuade the king and queen to support 3 further voyages to colonize the New World. But Antillia and its legendary riches were never found. Its name now lives on in a chain of islands in the Caribbean Sea, the Antilles. When the Caribbean colonies he established rebelled against him, Columbus suffered the ultimate humiliation. Dragged back to Spain in chains, he died a broken man in 1506. But without realizing it, Columbus had played an essential role in the history of Atlantis.
They expected to sail across the ocean and bump into Japan, but there was a whole continent in the way, and this, therefore, especially because it was across the Atlantic Ocean, this gave rise, I think, to much more speculation about Atlantis.
A good example of how the legend has been adapted or is different in each age is the time of great discoveries, when Columbus was crossing the Atlantic in search of the Spice Islands. He knew the myths. He wasn't a stupid mariner just hoping to head off and find something on the far side of the ocean. He was looking for things related to the Atlantis myth. We know that other seafarers were doing the same thing at the same time. So there was actually one of the impetuses for the exploration westwards across the Atlantic was the Atlantis myth.
Amid the spectacular ruins of the New World, the story of Atlantis would now take a different turn, becoming the focus for one man's bold quest to discover the truth about his country and himself. 30 miles from modern-day Mexico City lies Teotihuacan, the spectacular City of the Gods. It was already an abandoned ruin long before the time of the Aztecs, who regarded it as the birthplace of the sun. The Spanish conquistadors had been so overwrought by the city's majesty, one of their earliest chroniclers had written,
"There is now no cause why we should any longer doubt of Atlantis. The discovery and conquest of the Indies do plainly declare what Plato had written."
150 years after Columbus had discovered America, such sentiments would inspire one man to come to this city of silence and search for physical proof of the lost legacy of Atlantis. A search that was bound up in his own quest to discover himself. Though much of his story has been forgotten, Don Carlos Siguenza was among the most brilliant men of his age. A poet, mathematician, astronomer, and engineer, Siguenza was also one of the first archaeologists in history. Born in Mexico City, Siguenza was a Creole and considered an inferior by the country's Spanish rulers.
Siguenza was a Creole, which means he was descended from Spanish parents. Although we know now that perhaps there were Creoles who had part indigenous blood, they were not at the same level as Spaniards. They were not equal. They were inferior.
Overcoming the prejudices of Mexico's Spanish overlords had become Siguenza's self-appointed task from an early age. He was determined to prove that the ancestors of Mexico's Indians had once forged a culture to rival ancient Rome. Siguenza had first learned of Atlantis while studying to be a Jesuit, where he came across the work of Anathusius Kircher, whose 1665 map of the lost continent was the first in history. Expelled from the Jesuit order for his lack of discipline, Siguenza turned to science, making groundbreaking studies of eclipses, before journeying to Teotihuacan to see the city's ruins for himself. What he found there overwhelmed him. Carefully measuring and recording everything he could, Siguenza found Teotihuacan's layout truly mystifying. A puzzle that appealed to his mathematical talents and would bring him back to this ruined city time after time. The city bore all the hallmarks of an advanced civilization, and Siguenza found evidence of astronomy, hieroglyphic writing, and pyramid building that was uncannily similar to that of ancient Egypt.
He saw many parallels between Egypt and the early Mexican culture in the calendar, in the way of dress, in the hieroglyphics, and in the pyramids.
Could the two civilizations have been related?
I have been stimulated by the great love which I have for my country and in which would be found exceedingly strange information. This data will probably die with me on account of my great poverty.
But fortunately, some of Siguenza's works did survive, and we know that amid these vast monumental ruins, he believed that he had found the answer to the ancient riddle of Atlantis.
What he was trying to do, I believe, was to connect Atlantis, Plato's ideas, with the Bible. Siguenza would have jumped from the myth of Atlantis, which would have been kind of the foundation for him, to biblical prophecy of people dispersing across the globe after the deluge.
Fusing scientific ideas with his deeply held belief in the truth of the Bible, Siguenza concluded that the destruction of Atlantis and Noah's flood had actually been one and the same event. a vast deluge, which had swept away a forgotten civilization, forcing its survivors to seek refuge in both Egypt and Mexico, where they built the pyramid before vanishing from history. Siguenza believed that if he could show that Mexico's pyramids contained hidden chambers, as the pyramids in Egypt do, his theory about Atlantis would be confirmed. Under the hot Mexican sun, Siguenza and his servants spent many days trying to find a way into the abandoned city's pyramid. But the attempt ended in failure, leaving Siguenza frustrated and in despair that he could never convince skeptical Europeans of the true achievements of Mexico or its connection with Atlantis. Even worse, disaster was about to strike. In 1692, a riot broke out in Mexico City, provoked by cruelty and mistreatment from their Spanish overlords. Mexico's native population rebelled. Fires spread throughout the city. A mob broke into the Viceroyal Palace and set the country's national archives ablaze in one senseless act of vengeance. Siguenza raced to the scene. The archives contained countless documents that dated back to the time of the conquest. It was a vast body of evidence in which Siguenza hoped one day to find proof of his theories about the Atlantean origins of Mexico. Again and again, Siguenza plunged into the inferno, trying to save what he could. In desperation, he began paying rioters to salvage books from the flames. His entire wealth spent on saving just a few records.
I cut beams and pried open doors, and by my own effort, the best archives of the city were a rescue from the fire.
Because of his efforts, much of our knowledge of early Mexico and its conquest have been preserved. Tragically, after his death in 1701, most of Siguenza's own works were lost. With no means to date the great citadels and pyramids of Teotihuacan, Siguenza could never have known that the city did not reach its height until 750 AD, 10,000 years after the date Plato gave for Atlantis' destruction. But Siguenza was right about the secret of these pyramids. They did contain burial chambers hidden deep within them, a fact that was only discovered 3 centuries after his death. Don Carlos Siguenza was the first Atlantis seeker to search for physical proof of the lost continent. But he was not alone in wanting to cast new light on an ancient legend. Across the ocean in 17th century England, 2 courtiers of Queen Elizabeth I were also immeasurably broadening the scope of the quest for Atlantis.
One of the reasons that by the 17th century the Atlantis myth had become reintroduced was because there was much more exploration under Elizabeth I. And there was a renewed interest in science in Elizabethan England. This obviously would have encouraged people to reopen the Atlantis story, and therefore people began once again, if not to look for it specifically, certainly to refer to it specifically.
Francis Bacon was a statesman, playwright, and one of the first modern scientists. Eager to promote the merits of science to still a largely unscientific world, Bacon wrote a fable called The New Atlantis, the first reworking of the myth since Plato. The New Atlantis told the story of how survivors from the original Atlantis had founded an idyllic society in the still unknown reaches of the Pacific Ocean and used science to uncover the mysteries of the universe. Like Plato, he left his story tantalizingly incomplete.
Bacon refers to Plato, so this was the origin of his story, but it is not seriously an attempt to resurrect Plato's Atlantis, but to create a utopian society that the British could look at as a way of rewriting the way people could live together.
But Bacon's linking of Atlantis to advanced technology would stay with the myth ever after. As would Atlantis's association with a rather different field of human investigation. Dr. John Dee was an alchemist, spy, philosopher, and physician. Astrologer to the Queen herself, Dee was also the most famous magician of the Elizabethan age. Using a method of crystal gazing, Dee claimed to have communicated with the spirits of Atlantis in a series of terrifying occult experiments. Both Dee and Bacon considered their Atlantis works so subversive, they refused to publish anything about them in their own lifetimes. And it would be England's great rival France that opened the next chapter in the story of Atlantis. When Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1799, he took with him the largest collection of scholars ever to accompany a military campaign. The finds and discoveries made by Napoleon's archaeologists generated a national obsession with all things ancient. In time, inspiring a fellow Frenchman, Jules Verne, to take the story of Atlantis from the arcane libraries of a few lonely scholars into the imagination of the whole world.
Here were the encrusted remains of an Acropolis, with the floating forms of a Parthenon. Here were the vestiges of an ancient port on the shore of a vanished sea, which had once given shelter to merchant ships and craft of war. Further still were the outlines of crumpled walls and long lines of wide, deserted streets, an ancient Pompeii buried beneath the sea, Atlantis.
Jules Verne's image of Atlantis in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was perhaps the most spellbinding description of the lost city since Plato's.
It was published in 1870. Enormously popular book. The drawings that actually accompanied the book showed people marching around in sunken Greek temples, and this, of course, was kind of an interesting concept and probably was the element that got people more and more interested in Atlantis, the idea that underwater you could walk around in sunken Greek temples.
Written in the 1870s, as the effects of the Industrial Revolution and new technologies were rapidly changing the world, Verne's story of undersea exploration was a prescient guess of the shape of things to come.
It was really a Da Vinci kind of prophecy. The general population of the day had no idea about the oceans, really. Most people didn't know how to swim. Most people certainly had never been underwater. All they knew was that the ocean was populated by monsters of one kind or another that probably ate ships and certainly ate people.
Verne's description of Atlantis, located in an abyss of undersea volcanoes in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, was so convincing that within a decade it would inspire a writer half a world away to prove that Atlantis truly did exist. Here in his study in Minnesota, Ignatius Donnelly, a failed politician, wrote one of the greatest bestsellers of his age, making him the founding father of the modern hunt for a real Atlantis. His ideas launched a wave of Atlantis mania that has been with us ever since. A former congressman and lieutenant governor of Minnesota, Donnelly had railed against the tycoons of big business who controlled the politics of the day, choosing to champion the cause of the common man. His idealism, unfortunately, brought only political and financial disaster.
He started a commune in Minnesota with a man called Nininger. The commune was called Nininger City. It didn't seem to work very well as an idealistic commune, and by the time it was over, there was exactly one resident there, and that was Ignatius Donnelly.
By 1880, Donnelly was out of office and down on his luck, and so he retired to his study to begin the work for which he is now most famous, a book entitled Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. Donnelly had studied Plato as a boy, and the story of Atlantis had always intrigued him. With time on his hands, he decided to read everything and anything he could to find out, once and for all, the truth about Atlantis. Donnelly had been galvanized in his quest to find the location of the sunken continent by an archaeological find that had thrown all preconceived ideas about the myths of the ancient world into chaos. 10 years earlier, German businessman turned archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann uncovered on the coast of Turkey the ruins of the city of Troy and many of the treasures from this mythical war between the Greeks and Trojans.
When Schliemann discovered Troy, it completely changed the way people looked at mythology and archaeology. Before Schliemann, people had thought that what Homer had written was fiction. He made this up. There wasn't really a city of Troy, but what Schliemann did was he read Homer carefully, and he figured out correctly where Troy would be located if you performed a literal translation of Homer.
It was this astonishing find that persuaded Donnelly that if Schliemann could discover Troy by carefully rereading Homer, then he too might discover Atlantis by rereading Plato. Obsessed in his quest, Donnelly tirelessly searched for Atlantis and everything around him until a thesis slowly began to emerge. Donnelly found evidence of Atlantis having existed in the similarity of plants, animals, and ancient cultures on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean.
We find on both sides of the Atlantic precisely the same arts, sciences, religious beliefs, habits, customs, and traditions. It is absurd to say that the people of the two continents arrived separately at precisely the same ends.
The pyramids in Mexico were very similar to the pyramids in Egypt. The methods of writing, the hieroglyphics, were very similar. So he deduced from that that there must be a common source, which must lie somewhere in between those two continents, therefore in the middle of the Atlantic.
But where in the Atlantic might the remains of the lost continent be? By an amazing coincidence, the British Navy had just conducted the first undersea survey of the Atlantic seabed. It indicated that deep beneath the Atlantic, a vast ridge of undersea mountains stretched from Iceland to South America, their highest peaks being the islands of the Azores and the Canaries. For Donnelly, the riddle was solved. These undersea mountains had once been wholly above the surface, but due to their volcanic nature had sunk, destroying Atlantis in the process. When it was published in 1882, Donnelly's book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, was an overnight bestseller that portrayed Atlantis as a highly advanced seafaring empire with colonies all over the world. An empire that Donnelly believed
lived under a kingly government and had their courts, judges, records, their boats, their highways, aqueducts, wharves, docks, and canals. They knew the use of the magnet and of gunpowder. In short, they were in enjoyment of a civilization nearly as high as our own.
Donnelly's book sparked debates from every fashionable salon to the most prestigious academies of science. Atlantis fever swept the nation. In 1883, the New Orleans Mardi Gras even adopted it as its theme. Letters of congratulations arrived from all over the world, including one marked only Ignatius Donnelly, America. To Donnelly's astonishment, it came from William Gladstone, Prime Minister of the British Empire.
Though much pressed by public affairs, I have contrived to read an already appreciable portion of your book, and I am much disposed to believe in Atlantis.
Gladstone sent this letter and addressed it to Ignatius Donnelly Esquire, America. And Ignatius, being an Irishman and not wishing to be outdone, decided to reply to him, and his reply said, "The Right Honourable William Ewart Gladstone, the world."
I could not but smile. I was corresponding with a man whose word was fate anywhere in the British Empire. I could have uttered a war whoop of exultation.
Because his book was so popular, people tended to believe that it was fact. A good parallel, I think, is with Peter Benchley's book, Jaws. What Benchley has the white shark doing in Jaws does not actually happen. But think about how many people read this book and became absolutely terrified to swim in the ocean. It is possible for people to take what is essentially a work of fiction, but if it's presented cleverly enough, and if it has enough science woven into it, to believe that it's absolute fact.
Flushed by the overwhelming success of his book, Donnelly, now a wealthy man, turned his attention to the truth behind other ancient myths. But none of his other books ever came close to matching the success of Atlantis, the antediluvian world. Disappointed, he returned to politics, again without success. He died in 1901.
In many ways, politics was his undoing. There's a quote from an obituary which says, "The memory of Donnelly the politician will die. It is for Donnelly the author that we weep," which I thought summed it up.
Donnelly's book began a tradition of armchair exploration that has accompanied the search for Atlantis ever since. The father of Atlantology, Donnelly was the first man to convince the public that Atlantis really could be found. Little did he realize that his work would prompt a search for the lost continent that was literally out of this world.
In the late 19th century, a new fad swept America. Spiritualism took the country by storm.
Here in the New York apartment of an eccentric Russian aristocrat, the story of Atlantis was about to move into a whole new dimension. Helena Petrovna Blavatsky arrived in New York in 1873, penniless after years of traveling the world. But she was soon to become one of the greatest occult gurus of the modern era, the herald of a new age of spirituality in which Atlantis would hold the key to cosmic enlightenment.
She was very ugly, in conventional terms, and her dress sense was not very good. Somebody once described her as a badly wrapped parcel, or looking like a badly wrapped parcel. She smoked like a trooper. She swore like a trooper in broken English. She had gross eating habits. She is thought very rarely to have washed. And so she wasn't really a very good proposition in terms of any gainful employment. The only talent she claimed to have was an affinity with spirits.
With her air of cultivated mystery, her almost incomprehensible Russian accent, and her outlandish behavior, Madame Blavatsky soon became one of the stars of the New York seance scene, revealing to her guests through a series of bizarre spiritual contacts that she was in communication with mysterious forces. Mysterious forces from Atlantis. Although exposed as a trickster on numerous occasions, somehow Madame Blavatsky's appeal just kept on increasing. Before long, Madame Blavatsky attracted the attention of Colonel Henry Alcott, a former member of the committee that had investigated President Lincoln's assassination. The two soon moved in together.
They called each other Jack and Maloney, which doesn't suggest a sexual relationship, but they did live together. They lived together perhaps as pals, chums, friends.
Mysterious letters soon began appearing all over the apartment. Written in her own handwriting, Blavatsky claimed these materialized letters had been dictated to her by cosmic masters who were eager to inform Olcott of their shared mission. The messages told him he'd been admitted into the secret order of these cosmic masters, whose ranks included such great spiritual teachers as Christ, Buddha, Confucius, Solomon, and Plato.
Very few people are admitted to this wisdom, and the knowledge of Atlantis is part of that wisdom. Because, of course, the continent of Atlantis was the original settlement of these arriving cosmic masters coming from a different part of the universe to set up, as it were, human life, or what was to become human life.
After Atlantis' destruction, the cosmic masters had retreated to hidden valleys in the Himalayan mountains, venturing out only rarely to monitor the progress of the human race. Blavatsky claimed she had first encountered these cosmic masters when she herself had been traveling in Tibet many years before. Now, after an apprenticeship of 20 years, the cosmic masters wanted her to bring about a new age of spiritual enlightenment with Olcott's help. In 1875, the two companions set up an organization dedicated to universal brotherhood, the investigation of man's latent psychic powers and spreading the wisdom of the East to the West. They called it the Theosophical Society. Incredibly, within a decade, they had branches all over the world, including India, where Mahatma Gandhi would become a member.
You could say that without it, the New Age wouldn't exist. And so in that sense, it's had many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of heirs who are members of other religious movements which owe a great deal to theosophy.
There were, however, contradictions. From the very start, it was clear to Colonel Olcott that the woman entrusted with leading this new age of Atlantean spirituality was anything but a model of Eastern serenity and contemplation.
He was a natural administrator, in a way, with a great deal of experience. She was an oddball. She was an eccentric, she was headstrong, she was reckless, she was mad, she loved stirring up trouble, she loved dramas, she loved scenes, she loved screaming, swearing, she loved upsetting people, she wanted excitement.
In 1888, Blavatsky wrote a book called The Secret Doctrine, in which she attempted to establish the principles of theosophy, or God wisdom, that the cosmic masters had imparted to her. Blavatsky cited most of Donnelly's theories about Atlantis with approval, but she had one major disagreement. In her opinion, Donnelly's belief in Darwin was a grave error, and in one corner of her room sat a stuffed baboon as a constant reminder of how wrong she thought the theory of evolution was. Instead, Blavatsky proposed that the cosmic masters of Atlantis had been the real progenitors of the human race.
Occultism rejects the idea that nature developed man from the ape, tracing the origin of the species to the third race man of the early Atlantean period.
Blavatsky argued that while some peoples, notably the Aryan Hindus, had retained the Atlantean purity of their ancient ancestors, others had not.
The Aryan Hindu belongs to the oldest race now on Earth. The Semite Hebrew to the latest. There was a day when the Israelites had beliefs as pure as the Aryans, but now Judaism has become a religion of hate and malice.
Blavatsky's linking of Atlantis to ideas of racial superiority would later be seized upon by the most sinister forces of the 20th century. Madame Blavatsky died in 1891, and true to form, the grandmother of the New Age refused to go quietly.
Her last years, alas, were fraught with endless dramas, because although she had officially retired from the Theosophical Society, she couldn't stop meddling. And being a hellraiser, She took every possible opportunity to stir the pot. So she died rather sadly, really, because she was in the middle of a maelstrom of anger and scandal when she died. But somehow that's entirely appropriate. One feels she rather enjoyed it.
Madame Blavatsky's ideas cast a long shadow over the story of Atlantis, providing fertile ground for the mythmakers of New Age spirituality. But ironically, it would be the propagandists of the Third Reich who would first seize upon her theories of a pure Atlantean race. The year is 1933, and in Central America, one of the forgotten chapters in the story of Atlantis is about to unfold. Deep in the Guatemalan jungle, a German archaeological expedition believes it has unearthed finds which challenge many of our most cherished ideas about human evolution. Buried deep in the earth are the mortal remains of a people who don't even appear to be human. Remains which local people believe to be the forgotten race of Atlantis. From the moment the Nazis seized power in Germany in 1933, they inaugurated a series of quests in search of fabulous objects and places from mankind's earliest myths. The Lost Ark of the Covenant. The Holy Grail. The Spear of Longinus, which pierced Christ's side. And the Lost Continent of Atlantis. For Adolf Hitler, such places and objects held a dark promise of secret knowledge and limitless power. If the Nazis could find them, their armies would be invincible. Missions were dispatched all over the world from Wavelsburg Castle, the sinister heart of the Third Reich. Built on the intersection of four prehistoric pathways called ley lines, Wavelsburg was believed to lie in a zone of magical earth power, and thus a fitting place for the home of the Nazis' most elite troops, the dreaded SS.
Never forget, we are a knightly order, from which we cannot withdraw, to which we are recruited by blood.
Headed by Hitler's trusted lieutenant, Heinrich Himmler, the SS modeled themselves on an order of knights. The purest members of the Aryan race, they were the only men considered fit enough to pursue such ancient secrets as Atlantis.
The search for these sorts of objects had a dual purpose. On the one hand, it made for great publicity. I mean, this kind of stuff just looks good in the headlines, you know, with the archaeologists out looking for the Ark, or have found the Spear of Longinus and it's coming to Berlin. And, you know, the archaeologists actually were out there in teams looking for these types of objects. That is, in fact, an accurate element in Spielberg's films. In fact, there was a major concern within the profession that German archaeologists were going to become the laughingstock of their colleagues outside of Germany because of this type of lunatic fringe research.
How and why German archaeologists became so obsessed with pursuing these mythical objects and places has its roots in the disaster of World War I and its terrible aftermath, in which the myth of Atlantis played a fateful role in the Nazis' rise to power. The Great War had been greeted almost with celebration. After decades of peace, European leaders saw a chance for the manhood of their nations to be tested.
Many people at the outset of the First World War, many extremely distinguished, sensitive, refined people, were to be found writing paeans in praise of the war, of the anticipated slaughter, because they believed it would spiritually purify Europe. But they didn't believe that for long.
By the war's end, millions lay dead, and the map of Europe had been completely redrawn. Defeated by the Allies, the German and Austro-Hungarian empires fragmented, leaving German-speaking people all over Europe feeling humiliated and deeply insecure. Military disaster brought economic disaster, and Germany plunged into chaos. an unstable hotbed of hyperinflation and extremist politics. Insecure about themselves and their role in the world, Germans turned to history, hoping that in the ancient past they might find a way to reinvent themselves in the present.
We're dealing with a nation in the 1920s in Germany, which is going through a kind of identity crisis. It's feeling underappreciated, and obviously it's in search of symbolism that will allow it to feel better about itself. Basically, it's sort of a self-esteem issue. And archaeology was one of the ways that that Germans attempted to kind of create a picture of themselves that they could be proud of.
As archaeologists began excavating Germany's remote past, so a number of Völkisch, or people groups, sprung up all over the country. Formed to promote the unity of German-speaking peoples all over Europe, these Völkisch movements organized festivals and sports events, which celebrated the strength and vitality of the German race. Their members were also among the keenest advocates of a number of extremely unorthodox ideas that linked Germany's past with the myth of Atlantis. Published in the 1930s, the novels of Edmund Kiss told the story of how in the long-forgotten past, an ice moon from deep space had collided with the Earth, bringing with it the seed of Aryan man. Naturally superior to the ape men of the Earth, this Aryan race had established the world's first civilization on islands in the Atlantic Ocean, Atlantis. Most incredible of all, Kiss's novels were not meant to be purely fantasy. They were based on ideas which many Germans actually believed to be fact.
Edmund Kiss published a series of novels, at least four that I know of. The Glassy Sea, The Spring in Atlantis, The Last Queen of Atlantis, and then there's the sort of diaspora novel that talks about the eventual migration to South America. And these seem to have been quite popular. Certainly Himmler was a big fan, and Hitler believed that they were a true-to-life, if fictionalized, representation of what actually happened.
Kiss's Atlantean city closely resembled Plato's, but in the place of a fantastic temple in the center of the city, Kiss put a vast war office, echoing plans for the Nazis' rebuilding of Berlin. From here, the purest and most noble Atlantean leaders ruled an empire that spanned from the first cities of South America to the classical civilization of Greece. As Kiss wrote,
"Only time will tell where the limits of our power lie. We must build a community that will demonstrate to all the visible signs of our Nordic blood. The whiteness of our skin, the blueness of our eyes, our freedom of spirit uncorrupted by the base superstitions of religion."
Yet, just as an ice moon from deep space had brought the Atlanteans to Earth, so many ages later, another would bring about their doom, colliding with the Earth and destroying their continent. Kiss tells us that Atlanteans returned to the Arctic North, seeking safety in the ice and snow, which had once given birth to them. Far away from inferior races that might tarnish their noble bloodline, the Aryans of Atlantis rejuvenated, purified by the icy environment of the North. And here they were reborn as the Germans, awaiting the day when a leader would emerge to resurrect the Aryan Empire of Atlantis once more.
What Hitler and Himmler both seemed to like most about this was the cyclical nature of it, and the fact that you could extend Kiss's ideas into the present by arguing that Germany was again going through one of these periods where it had to purge itself, but it had to be tested, basically. It was beginning to become compromised in its superiority and purity, and that, of course, you need a leader to kind of guide you through this dark period, and Hitler was that leader. So from a propaganda perspective, Kiss's novels were gold for people like Himmler.
Enthralled by the concept of an Aryan Atlantis, German expeditions departed for Central America, where deep in the forest of Guatemala, they set about investigating the overgrown ruins of the Mayan civilization. A civilization that had reached its height long after the date given by Plato for Atlantis' destruction, it was nonetheless here that archaeologists unearthed strangely misshapen skulls that local people claimed to be those of Atlanteans. This documentary film, lost in the German archives, played to packed audiences in German movie theaters in 1933. Not wanting to dispel the illusion of a great find, the archaeologists remained evasive about what they had really discovered. These misshapen skulls were actually the result of an ancient Native American practice in which heads of young children are bound and deformed for religious reasons. But the Third Reich's obsession with Atlantis and other myths went much further than appeasing the German public's appetite for mystery. In 1934, a year after this film about Atlantis was made, Himmler formed the Annenerbe, a specialist division of the SS, recruited from some of the country's best universities. Though many members didn't yet know it, the Annenerbe's aim was no less than the reinvention of German history. The academics and archaeologists who joined the Annenerbe soon found their leader to be a difficult and troublesome taskmaster.
He had a habit of getting, 3 o'clock in the morning, getting a sudden inspiration, jotting down a memo, find out why butterflies migrate, or find out why crows tend to sort of gather at places of execution, and he would send this off to the appropriate unit, and, you can imagine this sort of appearing on someone's desk, and they're looking at it thinking, where did that come from? And if you were lucky, he'd forget about it.
When war broke out in 1939 and German armies swept across Europe, the scientists of the SS Annenerbe followed in their wake, using archaeology to claim that the Nazis weren't conquering territory. They were merely reclaiming land that once belonged to the Aryan race. As the war progressed, the myth of Atlantis began to assume a far more malign role. The lost, racially pure homeland of Atlantis now became the model for the new Nazi Germany.
That meant removing elements that were not Nordic from the population, from the breeding population and from the culture. And genocide then becomes an option. So I think the Atlantis myth plays a role there quite definitely.
Generally, myths of the Golden Age are extremely double-edged because they give authority and they give legitimacy to ideas which may otherwise find no justification.
Archaeologists and academics who had joined the SS Annenerbe, imagining they were knights of a new order, searching for the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, and Atlantis, now found themselves justifying and implementing the indescribable terror of the Holocaust.
You could not claim today, although people have tried, that, oh, well, we were just archaeologists. We didn't have anything to do with the medical research or whatever was going on in the camps. That's not strictly true, because, in effect, Himmler made it impossible for people to completely remove themselves from what other branches of the organization were doing. Everybody was part of this organic sort of web that had been created.
At the war's end, the full extent of the Holocaust became horrifyingly clear. Himmler, the chief of the SS, cheated the executioner by suicide, while his foot soldiers, the men of the SS Annenerbe, slipped quietly back into civilian life, anonymous, forgotten, and unpunished. The myth of Atlantis had come full circle, transformed from the story of an earthly paradise into the ideology behind a genocidal nightmare. Most of the men of the Annenerbe escaped punishment for their role in the atrocity.
Archaeologists who survived the war seem to have done a pretty effective cleanup job in the archives.
Atlantis' connection with the Third Reich was forgotten almost immediately. Nazi propaganda had harnessed the myth of Atlantis for deadly intent. But across the Atlantic, mythmakers of an entirely different sort were also reinventing Atlantis as pure fantasy. Hollywood. Most famous of all Atlantis movies is probably the 1961 Atlantis, the Lost Continent, in which a humble Greek fisherman called Demetrius saves the beautiful princess Antillia from the evil masters of Atlantis. But the Lost Continent was only the most memorable of a whole genre of B-movie adventure films and serials that have continued to reinvent Atlantis.
There's something about the Atlantis theory that everybody loves. And even now, or in recent times, people have used it in movies, they've used it in novels. There are serials made in the 1930s about Crash Corrigan and the undersea kingdom of Atlantis, and the wonderful kind of idea of Crash on a horse riding through Atlantis, which looks very much like the Monument Valley in the American West. Because I think they just happened to be there, and they said, well, why don't we make an Atlantis movie? Okay, you put the saucepan on your head, and we'll do that.
From the man from Atlantis who sought to help the U.S. Navy protect the free world, to the warlords of Atlantis who wanted to enslave it, Atlantis has been portrayed in almost every conceivable way, except as a real place. Astonishingly, that would all suddenly change. In the late 1960s, archaeological discoveries would bring Atlantis hurtling from the realm of fantasy and Hollywood B-movies onto the front pages of newspapers around the world. Hidden in volcanic rock on the Greek island of Santorini, scientists unearthed the lost city of a forgotten people, destroyed in an unimaginable catastrophe. All the elements finally seemed to fit, and the great city of legend would now make the world of science sit up and take notice. Santorini, once called Thera, is a beautiful collection of small Mediterranean islands encircling a central volcanic hub. With its breathtaking views and stunning sunsets, Santorini is a magnet for tourists from all over the world who visit to sample the unique culture of the Greek islands. But Santorini is much more than a picturesque holiday retreat. Hidden under layers of volcanic rock are the remains of a once proud city that perished in a terrible calamity over 35 centuries ago. A city whose destruction many people believe gave rise to the myth of Atlantis. The story of this momentous archaeological find began in the 19th century on another Mediterranean island 70 miles south of Santorini, an island called Crete. In 1899, the British archaeologist Arthur Evans had begun unearthing on Crete the remains of a mysterious civilization which seemed to have been completely forgotten by history. Based on Gnosis, Evans uncovered the remains of a powerful sea-trading people who worshipped the bull and built large labyrinthine buildings. Factors which encouraged him to name this unknown culture the Minoans after King Minos, a mythological figure from ancient Greek history said to have been the father of the Minotaur.
The Minoans are probably the single greatest mystery in all of classical history. We don't really know where they came from, and certainly don't know what happened to them. But they were building these elaborate palaces and making these fabulous frescoes long before anybody else was doing. This is 1500 BC, and remember that the Parthenon and Plato himself existed around 350 BC.
It was while excavating a Minoan villa on Crete some 35 years after Arthur Evans that a Greek archaeologist called Spyridon Marinatos discovered evidence of a huge volcanic explosion.
When he reached the foundations, my father found quite a large quantity of volcanic pumice. And so he thought, what is going on here? Was there a volcano? And he looked at the map and he thought, well, the closest volcano is the volcano of Santorini. When did this erupt?
Based on provisional calculations, Marinatos estimated that the volcano of Santorini had erupted in around 1500 BC. It was a cataclysmic explosion. Equivalent to 150 hydrogen bombs, the center of Santorini was ripped open as 50 cubic miles of rock vaporized. Debris was hurtled as far afield as Egypt and Israel. Gigantic tsunamis overwhelmed coastlines everywhere in the Mediterranean, and aftershocks were felt all over the world. The island of Santorini was shattered into fragments of its former self.
It's the idea of cataclysm. Something as violent as a volcanic explosion of that dimension is a bit like the extinction of the dinosaurs. It's such a dramatic event that it must have been recorded in history somehow. And the only evidence we've got of this eruption being recorded in oral tradition is the Atlantis myth.
Convinced that the explosion of Santorini held the secrets of the sudden demise of the Minoans, Marinatos decided to investigate Santorini itself and look for further evidence of this lost civilization. But war and a lack of funds held him back until 1967, when almost immediately he discovered the remains of an ancient city, Akrotiri.
The first trial spot he hit exactly on the city of Akrotiri.
Marinatos's find made headlines around the world. A forgotten people from ancient history wiped out in one apocalyptic blast. Surely this was the real-life basis for the myth of Atlantis.
I think it was the spirit of the times, the whole generation of my father, capitalized on the fact that myths are true. They reflect some distant reality of the past. And so as a result of that, all we need to do is to search and we will find this core of truth. So in the late 60s and especially the 70s, people thought they had found scientific confirmation for the end of a culture. And the next step was to say, well, that's Atlantis.
Entombed by a 30-foot layer of volcanic pumice for more than 3,500 years, the city was clearly related to the ruins of Minoan Crete. Hundreds, if not thousands of years ahead of its time, among the city's ruins was evidence of complex drainage systems, showers, flushing toilets, even hot and cold running water. Here too were exquisite wall paintings, their rich colors preserved by the centuries of confinement, their subject matter unlike anything previously discovered in the region.
We look at the frescoes and we see very free-flowing, beautiful art. And it's made scholars think of them as gentle people, people without any violence in them. We find that the cities and palaces on Crete are not fortified. So again, we get this vision of a sort of utopian society.
Clearly the Minoans had been an exceptional and artistic people, far ahead of their contemporaries in many fields. But were they really the Atlanteans of legend? There were both many similarities and many differences between Plato's story of Atlantis and the discoveries on Santorini and Crete. Like the Atlanteans, the Minoans had been in contact with the earliest Greeks as well as the Egyptians. But the Minoans disappeared from history near 900 than 9,000 years before Plato's time. And even though only a fraction of the city of Akrotiri has been excavated, so far it bears little resemblance to the city of Atlantis described by Plato. It is certainly nowhere near the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Academic opinion remains divided.
What Marinatos found was very important. He was able to produce evidence which could form the basis for at least part of the story of Atlantis. Maybe not the whole thing, but part of it. And that was the crucial thing.
There is no comparison whatsoever between the Minoans and the Atlanteans. The Minoans had a high level of culture, but nothing extraordinary. It was a very open society, and they had an empire, but it was run by a fleet, none of which seems to fit the description of Atlantis at all.
Nevertheless, there is one group of people who stick firmly to the belief that Santorini was Atlantis, the islanders themselves.
The islanders of Santorini, the residents of Santorini, obviously have a vested interest in making sure that tourists think that they have found the lost continent of Atlantis. And what do you get to do with that? You get to claim Santorini as one of the most important spots on Earth. And you also get to sell a lot of t-shirts and mugs and posters and everything that is possible with the word Atlantis on it.
But the entrepreneurs of Santorini would soon find they had competition in laying claim to the riches of being associated with Atlantis. Only months after Akrotiri was unearthed, the hippie culture of the 1960s discovered its own Atlantis, and it reflected a very different image of the lost continent. In the summer of 1968, the occupants of a small plane flying off the coast of Bimini near Florida spotted beneath them mysterious shapes in the clear waters. The sight quickly attracted huge interest, especially when fragments of ancient monuments were also found in nearby waters. Known as the Bimini Road, could these strange, misshapen rocks be the corroded ruins of ancient Atlantis? Their sudden, dramatic appearance had been foretold by one of America's most famous clairvoyants, Edgar Cayce, called the Sleeping Prophet because of the trance-like state in which he delivered his prophecies. Cayce had predicted that Atlantis would rise again in 1967 or 1968. But the circumstances of the discovery cast a shadow of doubt on the risen Atlantis. Not only had the Bimini Road been discovered by followers of Cayce, it also turned out that Cayce himself had been sponsored by a wealthy businessman to locate gold, oil, or other mineral deposits in the Bahamas. Unfortunately, on this occasion, Cayce's powers seemed to have abandoned him.
I've heard that Cayce was in the employ of businessmen who believed that he could actually find gold, and he, Cayce, then decided to produce Atlantis as some kind of a substitute for that.
The fragments of ancient monuments also have another explanation that is far removed from the ruins of Atlantis. They are almost certainly the remains of ships' ballast dating back to the time of Columbus, when ships needed to take on board and later dump extra weight.
You don't want all that ballast in a ship, you want buoyancy. You get rid of the stone, and there all of a sudden is a Corinthian capital from Rome or from what have you in the Caribbean.
Cayce also prophesied that a long-lost haul of Atlantean records would be discovered under the Egyptian Sphinx in 1999. Unfortunately, these records have so far failed to materialize, further discrediting Cayce's prophecies that Atlantis would rise again.
I think the Atlantis legend, if you like, has become a new religion. It's a new age religion. It's for all those people who are dissatisfied with what the conventional churches have to offer. I think modern people look to want to find something, something they can believe in, even if it's not reachable, not attainable. So they search for a utopia, a fabulous land, and they try and believe in that, even though they can never really find it.
But hope springs eternal. Using a dazzling array of high-tech and low-tech equipment, and spurning the skepticism of conventional experts, a new breed of fringe researcher continues the search for Atlantis. Is it a search without end? Or will advances in new technology finally reveal the location of lost Atlantis? Based in Torbay, England, Jim Allen is a former aerial photography analyst for the British Royal Air Force. And it is by analyzing aerial photography that Jim Allen believes he has discovered one of the lost continent's most distinctive landmarks, the vast irrigated floodplain of Atlantis.
Many people talk about Atlantis, a lost continent, city, whatever they want to call it, but nobody bothers to talk about the rectangular plain. And a large part of Plato's story is a very geographic description of this actual area.
Jim Allen believes the continent of Atlantis was actually South America. High up on the rugged floodplain in Bolivia, called the Altiplano, Jim thinks he has found the plain which Plato described.
There was a plain, said to have been the fairest of all plains, and very fertile. It was smooth and even, and of oblong shape, and canals of 100 feet were cut through it.
Could the Altiplano of Bolivia really have been the plain of Atlantis? Despite several expeditions, Jim has found concrete proof elusive, and academic experts refuse to even examine his ideas.
Well, some time ago I wrote to the leading archaeologist in Cambridge, who was the head of Cambridge College, and he returned all my material unexamined, and he wrote, "Atlantis is a subject in which I have never been interested," and I think that that reflects the archaeological opinion around the world.
Undeterred, Jim hopes that advances in technology will eventually force skeptical experts to sit up and take notice of what he believes is a watertight theory.
Modern technology, the satellite mapping, which is only available in the last 20 or 30 years, shows we can prove quite positively this is the elongated rectangular plane that Plato talked about.
Jim Allen is not alone in hoping that modern technology will reveal the location of the lost continent. Based in British Columbia, Canada, Rand Flemath also believes that satellite technology holds the key to finding Atlantis. Rand believes that in the ancient past, a catastrophic geological event shifted the outer crust of the Earth over its molten core, moving the location of Atlantis from the temperate Atlantic to the frozen South Pole. A theory called Earth's crust displacement. It has had some notable supporters, including Albert Einstein, whose correspondence on the subject runs to many pages.
To imagine an Earth's crust displacement, if you think of an orange and you take off the peel and then you reattach it, but if you had a lubricant in between, say the peel and the flesh of the peel, it's just the crust that's moving. The rest of everything inside is remaining stable.
According to Rand, a few Atlanteans managed to survive this unimaginable disaster and went on to found the earliest known civilizations, leaving to history many of the great monuments of the world. From esoteric and mathematical clues contained within these monuments, Rand believes he has managed to decode the exact location of the city of Atlantis, still buried under miles of Antarctic ice.
I think that we have found a very specific coordinates on Antarctica that have a strikingly circular object beneath the ice about 1,400 meters, about a mile down, which can be seen by satellite.
Critics argue that trying to locate Atlantis under miles of ice by satellite is doomed to failure from the start.
These people believe that the ice sheet kind of rotated like the loose skin of an orange and managed to find itself over Atlantis. The ice moves. The plates of the Earth move. Both of these things actually happen. But what doesn't happen is an ice sheet doesn't cover existing civilizations. If ice moves the way a glacier moves, it mows down existing civilizations.
Skepticism is normal in science. Ice is a very good preserver. And in the location that we're looking at, we're hoping that there is still something there. But who knows? 12,000 years is a long time.
Only time will tell if technology will prove the ideas of 21st century Atlantis seekers like Rand Flemath or Jim Allen, correct. Throughout the ages, Atlantis hunters have diligently followed the clues laid out in Plato's 2,000-year-old description. But is it a description of fact or fiction?
I think Plato used real characters so that people would accept it as truth. I think, however, that Plato knew he was writing fiction, and Plato intended to write fiction. I don't think that Plato believed a word of it.
But what might have inspired Plato to invent such a story? In 399 BC, Plato's revered tutor, the great philosopher Socrates, was arrested in the dead of night. Dragged before an open court, he was charged with corrupting the morals of Athens with his outspoken philosophical ideas, and sentenced to death. A fate he accepted without bitterness or regret.
Men of Athens, I honor and love you, but understand that I shall never alter my ways, not even if I have to die many times. For if you kill one such as I, you will injure yourselves more than you will injure me.
Surrounded by his closest friends and disciples, Socrates calmly drank poison and passed away into history as one of the great figures of Western civilization. But Plato could not be consoled.
Plato thinks of Socrates as the best and the kindest and the justest man who ever lived. And he sees Athens, a city he loves, turn against him and kill him. That, I believe, was devastating for him. So a lot of Plato's work is an effort to imagine alternative political and social organizations in which the horrible injustice that he sees having been done in the case of Socrates could never happen again. He would like ideally to create a world in which philosophy in the person of Socrates would be forever safe.
And one of these ideal cities, where a great teacher like Socrates would be safe and respected, is described in Plato's story about Atlantis. However, the ideal society is not, in fact, Atlantis.
Of course, one would say, oh, it's Atlantis. No, it isn't. It's Athens. It is the ancient Athens, the Athens that defeated the Atlanteans, which had all the features that Plato associates with this imaginary ideal state that he has just described.
So after all these years, Atlantis may be no more than a story invented by Plato to compensate for the tragic loss of his mentor, Socrates. In our own age, the name Atlantis resonates still, a spiritual realm of the New Age and a substitute religion, a space shuttle voyaging like Columbus into new and uncharted domains. Even a gigantic billion-dollar holiday resort where the excesses of Atlantis are all too real.
Curiously, we have an Atlantis in our own time now. There is a resort and casino in the Bahamas called Atlantis. And it's everything that Plato said Atlantis was. And this, to me, is the epitome of at least part of our current civilization, and it might even be argued that it's part of the downfall of contemporary civilization.
Each period in history, I think, reads both the accomplishment of Atlantis and the reason for its destruction in a different way.
And I think this is probably how the myth has always functioned, how many golden age myths have always functioned. We use them to project the things we most admire and of which we are at the same time as afraid.
A myth that reaches back in time to a lost golden age, Atlantis has haunted the pages of history like a restless, inconsolable spirit. A mirage sought in every age, it has been a medieval paradise of infinite riches, the cradle of our most ancient civilizations, an undersea ruin that captivated the world, and a mystical homeland where humanity's highest aspirations and most dangerous fantasies of perfection meet. The search for Atlantis goes on. Many of us just can't resist the idea that somewhere in the gloomy deep, Atlantis still lies, awaiting the day when some bold adventurer of new technology finally brings its secrets to light.
Until that day, if it ever comes, Atlantis will remain only in the depths of the imagination, a measure of our humanity or lack of it, a mirror of the hopes and fears of every generation.
Problem of Atlantis. I think there are a number of points that have not been generally considered. We think of Atlantis as an island, probably somewhere in the Atlantic, and probably about in the location of the present Azores Islands. But actually, Atlantis was a diffusion. If you buy a map now of the world as it is today, we can say that that is the modern distribution. But to have a map of Atlantis as it was in the time of its glory, you would have to have a map of the entire planet, because it was a distribution. Continents rose and fell. Islands came up and went down. Great land shifts occurred. And the Atlantic distribution of land was far more important and far more far-reaching than the mere problem of an island somewhere in the ocean. So we have to think of Atlantis in relationship to a complete pattern of the planet. As Plato clearly points out, the island of Posidonis, which we now think of as Atlantis, was the last fragment of a great empire. It is the last surviving part, and is supposed to have disappeared under the ocean about 12,000 years before the Trojan War, which would make it about 15,000 years ago. Now, in connection with the problem of Atlantis, I think the next thing we have to study is the name. Plato refers to the mysterious empire as Atlantis. He probably received this name, or secured it, from Solon, who in turn had received it from the priests of the Egyptian temple at Sais. Now, the word Atlantis, or its root, is not Egyptian, and it is not Greek. No one seems to be able to trace the origin of the name. It appears on two very important phases of ancient mythology, Atlantis and Atlas. And the root is A-T-L, Atal. Now, if we look to find the language in which that word or that root is permissible or was used, we find you'd have to come to the Western Hemisphere, because Atl was one of the month names of the Mayas. It also has more than just a name significance. Its glyph or its symbol is a deluge. This seems then to give us the real basis of our word, that we are dealing with a term that represents a world experience, that various countries were involved in it, that the circumstances were known around the entire planet, and that the name that has survived to us today is probably based upon the records on the Western Hemisphere. Now, if we take the general term to represent this mysterious region, we then can find from the Codex Trojano, which is in the museum in Madrid, one of the surviving documents of the Mayas, that this particular deluge is marked in the glyphs of the people. The story is told in pictures, but among these pictures, there is one in which the sky dragon or the sky serpent is pouring water from its mouth, and below this, the god of death is dancing on the earth. Now, this was a long time ago, long before the coming of the Spaniards, but the records even go much further than that. According to the Chinese, the previous existence before our present coming to this earth was destroyed. The previous world was destroyed by water, a tremendous deluge. And in the I Ching, the eight trigrams, basic trigrams, correspond to Noah and his wife, their three sons and their three wives, were the eight who were saved. And this is exactly what the Chinese tell us. So the story goes around, here and there and everywhere. It's a very interesting story, but what does it really mean? Is it merely an archaeological curiosity, or does it have some dynamic value for us today? I would like to think of Atlantis much as Lord Bacon did in his book, The New Atlantis, in which he says in very simple terms, the New Atlantis, which is America. Bacon was quite convinced that on the Western Hemisphere, a great empire would arise, an empire that would surpass the glory of the Atlantean story, and that this new world would not be destroyed. It would not turn against the gods. It would not misuse the energies of nature, and as a result would become a new world, a restoration of the Golden Age. Now, when we study this Atlantean problem a little more carefully, we realize there have been a number of speculations on this. Vice President Dawes made quite an extensive search for the Atlantean world. A number of good archaeologists and ethnologists have devoted time to it. And the general attitude is no longer to discard it as a fable, but to try to find out what its actual meaning could be. Now, let us suppose that Solon was correct, and that Solon, being an old man, was unable to do what he had intended to do, and that was to write out an account of the lost Atlantis as he found it, or it was given to him, in the caves under the Temple of Sais in Egypt. Here on columns formed of orichalcum, a metal that cannot perish, was recorded the story of a lost world. These two tablets are sometimes referred to as the Tables of Enoch, and we find a great deal of mystical lore surrounding this story. In any event, Solon, being very old and unable to carry on the work, passed the legend on to one of his descendants who was a student of Plato's. And this student, in turn, told Plato, who took the story, to use it as a great symbolical account of the descent of man. Now, Plato does not deny that the story is literally true, but he does point out so many very subtle and unusual details that we are forced to realize that he embellished it to represent the entire story of the planet Earth and its development. According to Plato, at a remote time, the gods of High Olympus distributed the world to their various sub-deities, and to Poseidon was given the lands of the sea, the great oceans, the islands, the archipelagos. And Poseidon created his kingdom in the oceans, and he created a wonderful city called the City of the Golden Gate. And in this city there was the temple to him, and in this temple were the tablets containing the laws of life, the laws that must be obeyed if man is to survive and to enjoy the favors of the gods. And the Atlantic Empire consisted of seven islands. These seven islands also occur in the Mexican story. These islands came together to form a league. And this league, in turn, created a kind of empire. And in the course of ages, the princes of the islands of the Atlantides became very proud. They decided that they would conquer the world. So in order to achieve this great end, they decided to send expeditions of conquest over all the other parts of the then Atlantean distribution. Now this distribution at that time consisted, much as it does today, of countries of various degrees of development. It was not an uninhabited world. The Atlanteans were not the only people. But these other people were comparatively primitive. They were like the natives of Africa or the natives of some Polynesian area or perhaps the natives of some distant islands of the South Pacific. They were primitive people, but they existed. And the Atlantean merchants went to them, traded with them, and bartered with them. Plato states definitely that Atlantis had a great mercantile, that it traveled to all parts of the world, that it even visited Europe and as far south as South America. But gradually this empire grew more and more proud. Gradually fame, wealth, and power became the great objectives for life. And there was another dimension. These peoples possessed extrasensory perceptions that had not yet been closed by the process of embodiment. They were like the extrasensory perceptions of small children in whom faculties are partly active, which are now dormant in our racial groups. So in any way, these magicians, these sorcerers, these powerful ones who possessed vril being the one motive power that is inexhaustible, something we could use today, that we'd carry anything, transport anything, activate anything that the human being could conceive. And so in their pride, these princes decided near the end of their time to invade what is now Europe. They decided to invade in the areas of the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Near East. So they sent great fleets to conquer these countries. In the meantime, the deities, particularly Poseidon, realizing what was occurring, gave warnings and sent prophets and told these people they were destroying themselves, but they were proud and they gave no mind or no thought to consequence. And finally, they rebelled against the gods, and the gods reacted accordingly. In a single night, the great center of Atlantean culture, the island of Posidonis, the last surviving fragment of an ancient order of life, disappeared under the ocean, and according to the Maya calendar, carried with it to death 60 million human beings. This was the end of a great cycle of misuses and abuses in which those powers, forces, and principles which had been intended to be of common good to all mankind were perverted and in one way or another turned against the will of heaven, and in consequence they were destroyed. Now this also causes us to have another little interlude here, which I think we should give a thought to. We are told by Plato and several other historians of the type of the time that various agencies, various merchants, travelers, explorers from Atlantis visited other lands. And among those who visited other lands were the priests of the Atlanteans, those who worshipped the great golden serpent. Serpent worship was one of the oldest religions of the world. Now these various missionaries, shall we say, went to primitive people as we send missionaries today to underprivileged or gradually evolving groups. And these missionaries set up various institutions in the distant parts of the empire, the parts that were not actually destroyed by the destruction of the Atlantean centerland. Now, it seems to me, and I realize that this is hypothetical, but it seems to me that this explains a series of legends and myths which are of interest. We are told, for example, that the people of Chaldea and Babylonia were very primitive, that they had not yet discovered the use of fire, that they did not know how to cook food, they did not know how to keep records, they had no medical knowledge. They had no laws to live by and no governments except tribal communes. And in the midst of all this time, while they were living along the shores of the sea, one day something strange happened. A being came out of the sea. This being, whom they called Oannes, had the body of a fish and the head of a human being, and wore on his head the head of a fish on end. If you see the old pictures, you realize that his hat was what we call today a mitre, which is practically exactly the shape of a fish's head. And this man who came out of the sea had scales. Now, scales could very well represent armor. He carried symbols with him, and he was a good man. And he came to these people, and he taught them. He gave them a written language. He gave them the knowledge of agriculture. He taught them astronomy and the mystery of the stars. He helped them to build a permanent government, introduced them into the mysteries of architecture and the building of cities. And he also taught them the mysteries of heaven and the ways of the gods, and taught them to live in obedience. And he told them that in due time, he would return. And then he went back to the sea, promising to come back one of these days, sometime in the future. And he walked out into the sea and disappeared. Now, this seems to me to be a veiled story, could be a veiled story, of an Atlantean traveler, a missionary perhaps, who came to these people very much as the Chaldeans coming along the coast of Brittany and France gave them the beginnings of the culture of the Druids. This one who came out of the sea, dressed in armor, probably came on a ship, which came over the horizon and was regarded as evidence that he came out of the sea. The most important thing, I think, in this legend is that he promised to return. So they waited. And they kept his laws and they kept his rules for years, but he never came back. Now, on the opposite side of the world, something else was happening. The people of Central America were living in a very primitive state. Some of them were cannibals. They had no homes except rude huts. They had no instruments except cuts, cut from stone. They did not know how to cook their food. They had no written language and no way of recording their history, no knowledge of any of these things. And while they lived in this primitive condition, a strange thing happened. An old man came to them, riding on the back of serpents. And he came to the shore, and he was welcomed by them, these peoples. And his name is preserved in the three great languages of the central culture of the period and time and place. To the Aztecs, he was Kukulkan. To the ones who lived around Palenque, he was Votan. And to the Mayas, he was Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. And this man came from the sea with a bonnet of wonderful plumes, almost like wings. And on his breast, he carried a cross. He came to them, and they received him with regard and esteem. and he taught them all the things that Lannes had taught the Chaldeans. He helped them to establish a permanent way of life. He gave them the beginnings of a written language, the only written language in the Western Hemisphere. He gave them good government. And then he said, "Now I go away. But keep the rules that I have given you. And in due time, I will return and claim the empire. But in the meantime, obey the principles I have taught." And these principles were of very high quality morally and ethically. Then this being went to the shores of the sea. And as he stood there, he said to the people that had assembled that a very bad power was coming to them. Tezcatlipoca, the god of war, was going to come from the south to destroy their empire. They should be true, however. They should keep the rules, and then he would return. Then there are two accounts of what happened to him. One that he called to the sea, and the raft of serpents returned. The raft of serpents could well have been a ship, with the very animal heads and so forth that were engraved and written or painted or carved on the heads of ships. The other explanation is that he was transfigured and rose to become immortalized and deified in the planet Venus. He said, "I will come back," but he never came. And when the Spaniards arrived many centuries later and their ships were anchored, the Aztec Emperor Montezuma took the plumes on the crowns, took all the symbols of regality, and sent them by ambassador to Cortes, saying that he was Quetzalcoatl returned, and that therefore he was returning the kingdom which his people had kept trustworthy for ages. Now, these stories are interesting. There's nothing you can do but remember these strange stories. The same story exists in China. In China, the world's reformation, the restoration of humanity, was the result of a mysterious being who came out of a fish's mouth and, rising out of the sea, taught them the secrets of life. In India, Vishnu, in his first incarnation, is born from the fish's mouth. Everywhere the sea was the source of instruction. Something came from the sea. We can't dogmatize what it is, but it is interesting that at a remote period, certainly 8 or 10,000 years ago, if not more, doctrines and concepts and beliefs reached all parts of the world and are still reserved and preserved in all the mythologies, legends, and allegories of ancient peoples, and were recognized as the ultimate source of civilization. Now, if these were missionaries, travelers, philanthropists from the Atlantean Empire, they might have wished to come back. They might have said that they would, or that others would follow. And then came the deluge. The center of the great wheel was destroyed. No one could come back. Little by little, these peoples in different areas modified their beliefs. Interracial minglings brought about complications of stories concerning the descent of knowledge. Here in the southwest of the United States, they have the legends that originally humanity lived under the earth. And a deluge came under the earth. And this deluge threatened the life of everything that lived. So humanity crawled up or climbed up to this upper world upon corn stalks and began to populate the earth. And the point where they came out of the earth is still sacred to the Navajo and the Hopi. Years ago, I had the privilege of bringing to California, temporarily, as my guest, one of the last of the great sand painters of the Navajo, Hosteen Claw. a few weeks ago when I was in Sedona, in Arizona, I mentioned Claw, and everyone knew who he was. One of the greatest men of his time, an Indian, and a remarkable person. At that time, when he was up there, we had just published our large book, and I wanted him to see it. He spoke no English. He had no idea of what the book was about. So I turned to the plate of the Table of Hermes, just in passing along through the book. You'll find it if you have it. And the old Indian stopped right there. It was Chaldean. He didn't know what Chaldean was, never heard of it. But he told me through Huskin Oswood, his interpreter, long, long ago, my people could read this. American Indian. Every once in a while, something like this happens, and no one knows why. But it all adds up to something that is very unusual and very interesting. I think if we follow all of the traditions that exist, we would summarize the highest terminal aspect of Atlantean culture as a very high culture, with scientific knowledge, with good map making, with many types of industry, arts, and sciences, accredited as having the first to domesticate the horse, with hospitals and clinics, and with various types of locomotion. And according to the old stories, the Atlanteans had the secret of flying through the air. We can doubt all these things. We don't know for certain. But we do know that there was on this planet at least 12, 15, 50,000 years ago, because the Atlantean disfusion and its empires probably lasted for better than 200,000 years before the final destruction of Posidonis, that there was a great civilization. One of the Hindu scriptures says, referring to the earth, the Great Mother has shaken many civilizations from her back. And maybe Atlantis was one of them. Maybe Lemuria was another. Perhaps Hyperborea was another. But in any event, far back, there were forms of life and culture very different from what we have today, which destroyed themselves by the misuse of the spiritual powers of life. So now we come to another interesting episode. In the last few years, there's been a great deal of emphasis upon extraterrestrials visiting our planet. Books have been written to show that somebody from outer space, presumably, who came here long ago, produced all kinds of mysterious monuments, records, engravings, pictures, and carvings, are supposed to have had airplanes, all this type of thing, and it was said to have come somewhere from outer space. The outer space theory has certain difficulties involving it, which have not been completely solved and may not be solved. We don't know. It may all be true. But what we seemingly have overlooked is the possibility that these records that we now consider to arise from extraterrestrial sources could be the records of the great civilizations that were here before they destroyed themselves. That these people who are said to have come and brought all the secrets of life to these primitive peoples could have been the citizens of the great Atlantic Empire, the empire that was far higher and far more advanced in many ways even than we are today. Their civilization was different. They were not bound tremendously to an industrial program. They didn't need it, and we wouldn't need it if we developed the resources within ourselves. The idea that we have to run the planet the way we're running it now simply means that we do not recognize that within ourselves are the answers to the questions that we now find so difficult. That actually, if we use the interior potential we have, we would have no need of all the problems of depressions and all the mysteries of exploitation that we suffer from today. How would it be to imagine for a moment at least that these so-called visitors were actually the Atlanteans? There is a long story of their activities, whereas the story concerning extraterrestrials is rather dim and hard to put together. We base the extraterrestrial idea on one point alone, namely that something was brought here or came here at a time before it would seem possible that the human being could have developed or evolved these resources. Some believe that they brought with them electric batteries. Others believe that they wore space suits. Some say they came in space ships. But none of these things really exist to our minds except in the form of paintings and carvings and imageries of one kind or another. The main foundation of our belief is that something happened by which a culture came here or was here prior to our ability to trace its source. If we assume that there was a great source already here, it would simplify a number of matters and make it much easier to account for the travel of these mysterious visitors. Suppose these mysterious visitors were simply part of an advanced culture here. I think we have the same thing in problems today. There are still areas in this planet right now where it is very dangerous for strangers to go. There are still primitive peoples who have no idea whatsoever of civilization and have never heard of it. And in spite of the tremendous spread of our way of life, there are large areas which have not been touched, or so lightly as to mean very little. If in a more ancient time, most of the planet consisted of comparatively primitive peoples, and the last of the great Atlantean diffusion, Posidonis, was an isolated island separated by water from practically all other areas on Earth. Most people living in other parts of the planet would have no knowledge of it, or if they had a knowledge, it would only be a legend, and perhaps the legend is responsible for another series of interesting beliefs. The World Mountain, Olympus, Asgard of the Nordic peoples, the whole series of the demigods who walked with men, the individuals who had apparently supreme power. Montezuma bowed down to them, and they were Spaniards in armor. And Montezuma believed from reports that these men were centaurs, half man and half horse, and was not able to understand that these men were riding horses, which the Indians knew nothing about. Here, less than 500 years ago, we have a situation in which a higher cultured civilization moved in on a primitive one and was mistaken for gods, until they proved that instead of being gods, they were ravishers of the earth. So in that type of thinking, we might also find a source for much of our religious thinking. These mysterious priests of the serpent of the city of the sun, these priests were undoubtedly wise in the mysteries of life. The ancient rites and mysteries of the Greeks and Romans and Egyptians, the secret and esoteric teachings that have descended to us from unknown antiquity, may very well have originated among the esotericists of Atlantis. There also seems to be quite a little evidence to the effect that when the great decision was made and the gods decreed that the Atlanteans had destroyed themselves and must be removed from the earth, that prophets arose among them in those last days before the end. And these prophets warned the people that they had disobeyed the gods, that they had sacrificed all that was good for selfishness, avarice, and power. And these prophets led certain groups of the Atlanteans away from Atlantis and into what is now Europe and the Near East. These peoples survived. As this migration occurred at least 12 to 15,000 years ago, we have some suspicion that many of the civilizations of the Near East, and perhaps even of the Far East, originated among these transplanted peoples who had gone away from the cause of death. It is stated in the Atlantic story that a great number of the gods of Egypt were, refugees from Atlantis. That the gods of the Egyptians were Atlantean deities who originally, perhaps, actually and physically lived as leaders of their peoples. In any event, the idea that the world was populated, in one sense, by refugees is not unreasonable. Another story of the same type, which is found in many parts of the world, states that the Atlanteans earned their final destruction by an attempt to invade Europe, that they raised a great army and sent it against Europe and North Africa. And this great army was on the march and was in these areas, claiming them, when the Central Islands were destroyed. Therefore, these armies could not return. There was no place to go back to. And many of them settled and mingled with the peoples of these areas to form some of these wonderful and mysterious civilizations which we have no real explanation for. We have very little explanation for how racial differentiation in recent times came about. Various anthropologists so far have charts showing what happened. But as is the case in most of science, no one seems to know how it happened or why it happened. These things occurred. New blood streams came forth, mingled and mixed and intertwined. And each one brought with it part of its own culture. And these parts of ancient cultures seem to linger on, perhaps in lingual differences, in arts and crafts, in psychological structures, in habits and principles, and even to a measure in bodily form and structure. In any event, as Bacon points out, we have a challenge coming to us at the present time. And this challenge is more or less documented in terms of Atlantis, and I think this is the way Plato originally used it. You know, the story of Plato's Atlantis ends in the middle of a sentence. It was never completed. Bacon's new Atlantis ends in the middle of a sentence. It was never completed. Why? We don't seem to know. But I think that Bacon tells us about the importance of it, that the destruction of Atlantis as left by the tables of Enoch is this great story of the disaster of disobedience. That regardless of how we think about life or what we believe about life, it is impossible for us to go contrary to the will of heaven. Anything that goes contrary comes in the end to destruction. Plato and several others of the earlier writers also seems to fabulize this particular situation. Atlantis may be the submerged self in each of us. This is an interesting possible thought from a psychological standpoint. The psyche may be that part of our nature which alone bears witness to its ancient origin. If there is a record of disobedience and penalty, that record is probably primarily descending within the structure of the human being himself. It is something hidden in his own darkness. It is something that may bring him fear, It may bring him conscience. It may warn him of the dangers of the abuse of power and energy. And if so, it may be the submerged part of man's own nature, that part which was lost because of disobedience to the gods. This may be the large, deep, all-spreading mystery of the fall of man, which has been also recorded in various ways among practically all peoples of the earth. Atlantis also seems to have a very great fascination for the psychologist and the social reformer. Is it true that a civilization existed long ago which knew what we do not know today? Is there something lost in our way of life because it disappeared under the waters of the Atlantic so far back in our story? Is it true that there were giants upon the earth in those days, mental giants, that had skills and abilities which they had derived from the studies of esoteric matters? Did black magic originate in Atlantis? It probably did, according to the Platonic discussion, because it was in Atlantis that for the first time man disobeyed the gods. And from disobedience fell the angels. The entire story of human progress, so-called, is today very largely a record of disobedience. The individual has broken the rules of life. Some people, having broken the rules of life, try to study esoteric matters, hoping to find the secrets of some strange magic of long ago. But if they are those who have broken the rules, and they are seeking a knowledge which they do not deserve and which they do not have the character to use constructively, they could cause another deluge upon the face of the earth. Therefore, every effort apparently has been made in ancient times to protect the secrets of essential knowledge. There are records of legends and accounts everywhere of secret teachings, esoteric schools. There are accounts of ways by which the human being can develop faculties and powers at present beyond his capacity. The scoffer says the whole thing is superstition, that there are no such forces, but that isn't proven by scoffing. It is only proving by testing. I remember years ago when I was in India, I met an old gentleman whom I make the hero of a book called The Guru. This old gentleman was a guru. I was never a disciple of his or anything of that kind, but I did know him. And we've talked about many things relating to the yoga, Vedanta, Tantra of India. These secret arts, which are said to have been given to the world by the gods in ancient times. And in talking about it, you see, this old gentleman was sitting there very quietly on a little white square like a sheet in his room in a little stucco house in Calcutta. He was sitting there with about 11 feet of his own hair. So I said to him, I'm going back to the States, and as one of the holy men of India, have you a message you'd like to have carried to the American people? And the old gentleman, sitting in the midst of his hair, where it joined his head, it was pure white, at the outer end it was black, looked me straight in the eye and said, yes, there is. Tell the American people to be practical. That sounds like a very strange thing to say under the conditions. Because if there was anything that ever looked impractical, it was what he was doing. So I carried that question a little further. And he explained to me, he said, I would like to make a recommendation. He says, send over to us 5 or 10 of your best equipped scientists, the ones who have the greatest knowledge that your academies and schools, universities, and institutions can produce. Leave them with us for 10 years, and they will reform Western wisdom. We have built it all on the outside, when in fact we have failed in the greatest mystery of all, the realization that within ourselves are the secrets we are searching for everywhere else. And also within ourselves are energy resources which cannot be exhausted, and that there can be and should be an overscience of life by means of which human beings could build a world that would endure, a world that would be worth living in for everyone who lives here. Now, the old masters of the magic of Atlantis lost all by perversion. They lost themselves and they lost their lives. They lost their world and their beautiful cities and their temples. Nothing remained because they failed. Now, at the moment, we can also remind again of the Atlantis of Bacon, namely, what we have to do. He said, Bacon in the New Atlantis said that the motto of the great Atlantean experiment was that man should learn to know all that is possible for man to know, and should dedicate all he knows to the unselfish good of all that lives. Well, it's a pretty big order, and we're not working that way too well at the moment. But the principles still remain true, that when the individual works for himself, his empires fall. When he works for the common good, he builds that in which is the spirit of everlastingness. Now, among the mysteries that have been involved in the Atlantean story are the pyramids. And the pyramids are very interesting things. We know that they are in Egypt. We know that they're in Central America, but a year or two ago, I saw aerial photographs of pyramids in the heart of China, which are not generally known, but it's been recognized. These pyramids, like the mounds of antiquity, seemingly have a meaning. And what that meaning is appears to be also rather uncertain. According to the conservative Egyptologists, and Mayaologists for that matter, the pyramids were simply magnificent monuments to the memories of dead pharaohs, kings, or emperors, or, if you want to be a little more idealistic, perhaps the testimonies to God and wisdom. But the pyramids are very strange things. Their distribution upon the surface of the earth is most extraordinary. Work is now being done, and I hope it will be carried on to a successful conclusion, to study and chart the locations of pyramids in relation to the magnetic fields of the planet. We know that the planet is a kind of crystal, that it has areas of fission, that it has magnetic fields, and that these magnetic fields are very important to the survival of life and to the distribution of energies. These magnetic fields may sometimes be the substitute for every method of locomotion or all forms of fuel in the world today. I went to the Pyramid of Giza, and I went through all the interior chambers of it. And there are some things about it that are very, very strange. Why should a tomb be ventilated? There are two great passageways leading from the king's chamber to the outside wall of the pyramid. They are like ventilators, not large enough for a person to go through, but large enough to permit a current of air. And then, after some time, no one knows when, the outer ends of these ventilators were blocked. But the openings to the inside are still open. The Great Pyramid's King's Chamber has in the ceiling the largest stone, I guess, in the entire structure. It weighs many, many tons. The sarcophagus, so-called, has been largely nicked away by tourists, but there is a lighter stone box, much in the shape of a casket, but too small for a human body. The way the Egyptians mummified their dead and put one mummy case and sarcophagus and over another before a final interring in the stone vaults could not have been done in this case at all. It would have been utterly impossible. Yet also another interesting thing happened. Way back in the days of the glory of Baghdad, the great Sultan of the follower and descendant of the great Al-Rashid of the Arabian Nights, Sultan Al-Rashid bin Mamun, decided to open the Great Pyramid. He had been told that it was built by giants who were called the Shaddai, superhuman beings, and that within that pyramid and those pyramids they had stored a great treasure beyond the knowledge of man. So, taking his court with him, the Sultan went to Egypt, and he stood and looked at the Great Pyramid. And at that time, all the casing stones were in place. The four walls were perfectly smooth. There was no visible opening of any kind. And he didn't know exactly what to do. But he heard from legends where he supposed the entranceway was, and he began to dig there. And they had a very fine way of digging in those days, which I think we have improved on. They had to use cold chisels and vinegar to go through the stone. And when they got through a certain way, they did find that they had come very close to an entrance, but a great stone blocked it, and they could go no further. The Sultan or Caliph looked at the stone. He said, "Take it out." So they went to work on that stone with vinegar and very soft metal tools. And last for the great trouble, they managed to get the stone out. And as they took it out, another stone fell in its place. And they had to go through stone after stone before they could get into the building. Now, you don't do that just to bury a burial. And at last, when they got all the way in, there was nothing. The only thing they found were a series of little implements, like a little ball that could be used to make sure a surface was even. If you stood the ball on it, if it rolled off, the surface wasn't even. And two or three other little tools. And the dimensions of the building itself. Now, the Shaddai was supposed to have buried all this treasure. Did they really bury a treasure in there? Were those little instruments the treasure? And were the dimensions of the pyramid and its interior structure this priceless secret that was far more important than gold? It has been worked on. Some have decided that the Great Pyramid was a great book of prophecy. Some say that it was built by the Atlanteans. Some say that it has the most perfect mathematical form and the great most perfect measurements of anything on earth. They have measured the orientation of the pyramid, and it's oriented up to the eighth or ninth decimal point. And the little error that does exist, this little fragmentary error, is probably due to the fact that there was a minor earthquake that shook off that corner. The building was built by somebody who knew a great deal. Now, if you only want to go back as far as Cheops or Khufu, we have to admit under those conditions that the Egyptians were pretty smart people. Because if they built the pyramid, they had a knowledge not only of architecture, but a knowledge of mathematics, and a knowledge of astronomy, and a knowledge of geography that was prodigious. They knew more about all of these subjects than we knew 100 years ago. Something in this story is another evidence that somewhere in the past there was a very great amount of knowledge. And if it was true, or is true, that the pyramid was oriented to the Star Vega, then the entire history of Egyptian philosophy and mathematics is set forth in that building. The Egyptians themselves, at a very early time, said that the Great Pyramid of Giza, Pyramid Number 1, was originally the tomb of Hermes, and that in that building was the great key to the Hermetic philosophy, which was restored in Alexandria in the first century. Now Hermes, as the Hermetic tradition tells us, was the god of wisdom, a being known to the Greeks as Hermes, known to the Romans as Mercury, known to the Egyptians as Thoth, the god of writing. And the last poem, by the way, of Longfellow, was an ode to Hermes, in which he said, "Trismegistus, three times greatest, how thy name sublime has descended to this latest progeny of time." Hermes Trismegistus, the embodiment of all knowledge that is knowable of nature. Hermes was the symbol of cosmic mind, of absolute knowledge. He was described as having written all the books of the world, because every book was written by mind. He was the keeper of the great secrets of life, the guardian of the mysteries. And this work includes a discussion of the Great Pyramid. Certain Hermetic books, probably written about the first century, but credited with a greater antiquity, include a work written by Hermes, presumably, to his son Tatian. And he says in this book to his son, he says, "The day shall come when Egypt shall be no more glorious, that nothing will remain of this great empire except broken columns half covered by the sand." And that was written over 2,000 years ago from existing manuscripts. So the entire problem of Egypt ties into Atlantis through the pyramids and other ancient monuments. Let's see now what we could say about this pyramid in study of man at the present stage of his evolution. For some reason, we're not very sure of, the pyramid is on the reverse of the seal, the Great Seal of the United States. No one knows exactly why it was put there. No one knows who it put it there. The custodian of the Great Seal, back about turn of the century, wrote a book on the story of the Great Seal of the United States. And he said the reverse of the seal, the front of course is the eagle, the reverse of the seal has never been cut, for the reason that it is nothing but the dull symbol of an esoteric society. Well, that esoteric society, of course, numbered among its followers Washington, Franklin, probably Jefferson. But in any event, the seal was not cut. Now, the soldiers of the Revolutionary War were paid their wages in what we would term feudatory notes. They were simply local printing paper with practically no value. Nearly everyone who financed the revolution went broke. But these little notes that were passed around, one of them has that pyramid on it before it was on the seal of the United States. And later it was moved onto the states in a paper. Now, when was the Great Seal cut? It has been cut. It was cut during the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and has since been found on the reverse of our dollar bill. This seal is apparently the symbol of a monument. A monument which, according to the Bible, was set up in Egypt to bear testimony. It was quite possible, and people are beginning to work more and more on it, that the study of the pyramid is very, very important to the solution of our relationship to the ancient world. We like to think, in our own way, that we are just here to do as we please, that we can make the mistakes we like best, that there is no definite providence to guide us, that our ancestors are all dead, and that nothing was deader than the Roman Empire. But we are not at all sure of some of these attitudes. And as our own problems increase, as they are increasing today, it becomes very obvious that we are not able to handle our own destinies at this time. We do not know where we are going. We have no idea how we're going to get there. And about the only thing we can do at the present time is try to figure out how we can have more guns or bombs than somebody else as the basis of survival. Now, this doesn't really make very good sense. It is not the answer. There is a grand plan of life, a grand purpose. It has existed among every people, and every nation has finally turned away from it and disappeared. The ruins of the past are a constant record of the individual's inhumanity to man and his failure to keep the principles of his own survival. The science of survival, then, suggests that there must be a plan, and that that plan must be available to man if he wants it, or is willing to do that which is necessary to have it. If he is not, he will not get it. Now, there's an interesting story we don't hear much about also. Hermes, among the books which he is attributed as having written, was one which is called the Black Book. Now, the Black Book is another legend. Very difficult to find much out about it. But one thing we know is that in England, the Order of the Garter was formed not because of an accident to a lady's garter, but because the original meaning of the word, as it appears and was gradually, colloquialized, it was the Order of the Garter, the protector. And if you have visited the Chapel of the Garter at Windsor, you will see the throne of those who were the members of the order. And according to the ancient order, as recorded by its first great historian, Sir Elias Ashmole, back in the 17th century, the original laws and rules for the order were taken from the Black Book of Hermes on the deportment of kings. And the entire structure is so constituted and the thrones are so arranged that it represents really a heavenly temple in which all the gods of antiquity were seated. It is also a very appropriate symbol of the first great League of Nations, that it was a symbol of the union of the rulers of the world for the maintenance of peace. The Knights of the Garter were all rulers. And I remember when I looked at it, there upon the flag of banner of the chairs was the flag of the Emperor of Japan. The Order of the Garter was an international order of leadership. And the Knights of the Garter, in their rights, drew their swords, overlapped them, and formed together a circle of blades resembling a great star. The Knights of the Garter were sworn to the protection of the weak, to the justice that is in the power of the ruler to bestow, and that all together, each in his own way and in his own faith, took his obligation to the God of his fathers to keep the peace. Then something happened. The Black Book disappeared. And the parts which had not been transcribed, which had to do with the rules of conduct down through time, have never been found. Again, something mysterious happened. But that it did exist, Ashmol assures us. The same type of thing comes with the order of the round table. Another type is with the legends of Charlemagne. All of these things go way, way back. But they all lead to one concept, namely that there is an over-government of the world. That this over-government is the government of the gods from their Olympian thrones as personifications of the great forces of life by which the universe is maintained. We do not have to believe in Olympian deities, but the integrities which they stand for or symbolize are the basis of human life. And unless these integrities are maintained, nations will fall. And every nation up to the present time has passed through great vicissitudes because of its inability to keep the rules of life. In the Greek and Egyptian worlds, those who were dedicated to trying to live a better life were gradually accepted into the mysteries. And these mysteries were among the things that Solon participated in when he was initiated into the rites of the Osiris and Isis. According to the legend, Solon was taken into the basement or cellars of the temple. He was taken way down under the earth by the side of the Nile. And in the very depths of the earth, there was a subterranean lake. And it was all black and dark. And on the shore of the lake was a little boat with a blind oarsman. And in the center of the lake was a small island. And on this small island were the two pillars of Enoch. So Solon and the priest who guided him went out to the island, and the priest showed him these strange hieroglyphic writings on these columns. And it described how various destructions had afflicted the world. And it said that the Atlantean Empire was destroyed by water. But if the solution wasn't found, if the world did not become aware from the ancient evidence and from daily living that there was no way of breaking the rules of living and surviving, then another great civilization might rise. And if this one rose, and it was necessary to punish it, it would be punished by forces moving in the air. Solon took this back. Didn't know exactly what to do with it. But he realized that he had been in the presence of something very sacred. That the priests themselves believed this. And it was written on this column of indestructible metal that had been there before the dawn of time. Incidentally, there is a column in India that is much the same. It's in Delhi. It just looks like a pillar rising out of the ground, maybe 9 or 10 feet, maybe 8 or 9 inches in diameter, with a kind of a colophon on the top, and inscriptions in language that no one can read. No one has ever been able to read. It looks like I am. But during the Sepoy Rebellion, that column was hit by a number of solid shot cannonballs. The cannonballs were broken into fragments, and there was not even a dent on the column. It is believed that this column also goes to the story of the Orichalcum, of which the walls of Atlantis were built. Everywhere you trace around, you find interesting things to remind us of something. And I think what it's trying to tell us is that we are one step in a great project, a project that leads from the primitive to the ultimately enlightened. that all along the way, just as human beings are young, grow old, and pass out of embodiment, generation after generation passes, so nations after nations come and go. The great thread of life is never broken, but there can never be an enduring culture until it keeps the rules. And these are the same rules that Plato tells us about, that Solon found, namely that we are surrounded by a tremendous field of energy. We are surrounded by the potentials we have no knowledge of. Space is full of the energies and life that we are trying to now find by artificial means. The human body is an incredible instrument, and its value has been largely destroyed by the fact that the owner of the body is unwilling to treat it properly. So nation after nation rises and goes down because it does not keep the rules. And this will continue until man, in one way or another, becomes aware of these rules. Now, the speculation about the Atlantic story, to my mind, should not be where was it and what was it, primarily. The main question is to find out what the story means and what it means to us today, to make this idea practical. We learn from this story, for instance, that a great civilization can perish. We learn that great empires can fall. But what we haven't learned, really, is that these disasters are caused largely by the corruptions of the human being. That man himself is his own destroyer. And that he will be his own destroyer as long as he follows the ambitions of world domination, as long as he lives to conquer peoples, as long as he lives to accumulate an unreasonable wealth, where he is willing to compromise integrity for fame, where he is willing to live only for today and let tomorrow take care of itself, he should look back and see how the tomorrow of Atlantis took care of itself. The individual himself sickens and dies from his own corruptions. Nations do the same thing. But in every nation that perishes, something survives. And one of the things that survives is a knowledge which can be reorganized, reintegrated, and reformed. We have gained from the past many skills and many wonders, but these are not enough unless we ensoul them. We can gain any skill we want, as today we are working with computers. We can have all the computers we want, but men will be born and suffer and die just the same unless we use these computers to solve the great problems of life. And having found that those answers can be discovered, live by them when they are found. All knowledge has as its final purpose that the individual shall overcome his own ignorance, and that society shall overcome its compound ignorance. And ignorance is nothing but the belief that we can break the rule and survive. So the Atlanteans left us this message, the Mayas left it to us, that the great world patterns, the great world systems with which we are concerned, have all perished from one source. We call it ignorance. And it is ignorance in a sense, because as the Chinese point out, any individual who does wrong is ignorant. No matter how learned he is, no matter how many years he spent in school, no matter how many honors have been bestowed upon him, no matter how much wealth he has accumulated, if he has not the understanding of the importance of complete integrity, he is ignorant. Ignorance is the inability to use wisely what the skills of the mind have given us. And until we realize this, we will be perishable. And just like the Atlantis of old, we shall be teetering on the edge of oblivion unless we ourselves make the necessary changes in our concepts and our conducts. Bacon pointed out that there was in the great city of the New Atlantis, in Solomon's house, there was a tremendous collection of all of the arts and sciences that man had known. That in here, all the wisdom, all the value that humanity had accumulated was in a great museum, a wonderful place, a gallery. And also here were the busts and statues and portraits of the great illumines, those who had given man the great donations and gifts of wisdom. Here was made available to the individual the accumulated wisdom of the ages. Everything of astronomy, of medicine, of art, of literature, everything of science. So, each one coming into the world comes into this gallery, and here he sees all that the world has done, all the achievements of the past, and then he is reminded of the simple fact, you have seen all these things, you know they have been accomplished. Therefore, your problem is to take these things and use them for the good of all that lives. Unless somebody, somewhere along the lines, comes to this conclusion and takes this attitude towards all knowledge, the dangers of the deluge remain. The danger that we will tear down or lose a tremendous asset by abusing its use. Actually, it is the same in our personal lives. Unless we control our minds and emotions, unless we organize and rectify character and conduct, we are abusing the priceless privilege of growing, which is our birthright. And those who have abused the birthright get into trouble. So Atlantis stands for a lost cause, not lost because the gods merely wanted to destroy a people. Atlantis was destroyed because it was too dangerous to let it live. It meant that if it was not destroyed, evil would spread throughout the world, would afflict all peoples, would tyrannize and dominate and corrupt everything that exists. Before this can happen, so many laws are broken, so many energies are abused, that all these broken rules and these abused energies get together and destroy the source of the corruption. Just as evil creatures, bacillus, virus, and all these things, come and destroy bodies that have been made infirm. So in the Atlantic story, we have a moral lesson of importance, in addition to a fascinating ancient fable. Thank you very much.